Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 136, Let This Be Our Final Battle. Last week, we left off in March of 317 AD, with Constantine and Licinius renewing their imperial alliance. For Constantine, the settlement was something of a disappointment. After all, he had beaten Licinius twice in battle, but two sunsets and some clever maneuvering on the part of the Eastern Augustus had conspired to deny Constantine outright victory. For Licinius, though, the settlement was a huge relief, a classic case of snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. Well, stalemate from the jaws of defeat, anyway. But you know, when you head into the endgame with nothing but a king and two pawns, stalemate and victory look pretty much the same. Licinius's position was far weaker after the settlement than before it, but he was still Augustus, he still ruled the Eastern Empire, minus what he had been forced to cede to Constantine, and perhaps most important of all, he still had his head. As I mentioned last time, following the settlement, Licinius returned to Nicomedia, while Constantine set up shop in Sirmium. Constantine wanted to establish his authority over the newly ceded Middle Empire, yes, but he also wanted to make sure that he was right on top of Licinius, in case the Eastern Augustus ever slipped up. So he made his headquarters along the Danube River. This meant, though, that the always volatile Rhine frontier, where Constantine had spent the majority of his reign thus far, was no longer under close imperial watch. This, as you can imagine, made the local Gallic citizenry nervous and hostile German tribesmen giddy. But both the fear and the giddiness turned out to be misplaced, because everyone was about to discover that the always volatile Rhine frontier was actually still under close imperial watch. Now probably in his late teens, the newly anointed Caesar Crispus was dispatched by his father to govern the western provinces following the settlement of 317. Crispus would set up his capital in Trier, and for the next 5 years would run the government and defend the frontier better than anyone could have reasonably expected. He defeated German tribes in battle in 318, 320, and 322, and in the process demonstrated to everyone that he was every bit his father's son, a brilliant commander and a savvy politician. When father and son visited Rome together in 320, it is reported that the ovation for Crispus was louder than the ovation for Constantine. And while I hope it wasn't something as petty as jealousy that ultimately led to Crispus's tragic demise, it is definitely a possibility. Also a possibility is the fact that Fausta would bear two more sons for Constantine during these years, Constantius II in 317 and Constance in 323. Can the wicked stepmother trope really be too far behind? During the interregnum between the First and Second Civil Wars, Constantine and Licinius continued to drift apart, not just personally, but politically as well. Up until this point, the two emperors had been rivals, yes, but they had more or less pursued the same policies. Round about 320, though, this began to change, and once again, Christianity was at the center of imperial division. Just as Constantine was stepping up his support for the church, Licinius was dialing his back, until finally, he abandoned the Edict of Milan and renewed the persecution of Christians in the East. His persecution had none of the bloody overtones of the Great Persecution, but in the early 320s, Licinius began to target church property for confiscation and target church leaders for harassment. Back in 314, his political enemies had been the militant anti-Christians, and so Licinius had ruthlessly enforced the terms of the edict. But now that his rival was no longer Maximinus, and instead a very pro-Christian Constantine, the Eastern Christians, who had once been Licinius's allies, were now suspected of being dangerous fifth columnists. Licinius knew a political threat when he saw it, so he abandoned the edict, and went after a group of people he probably rightfully suspected of harboring cross loyalties. But how hard Licinius pressed the renewed persecution is difficult to determine. Because Constantine would specifically cite Licinius's treatment of the Christians as one of his main reasons for going back to war, separating truth from propaganda is a tough assignment. What is a less tough assignment is determining the nature of Constantine's treatment of the Christians in his domain. Because with each passing day, it was becoming more and more apparent which religion was the Western Augustus's favorite religion. As late as 315, when his triumphal arch in Rome was erected, Constantine was still pretty vague about his religious beliefs. The arch only refers to the fact that Constantine was, quote, inspired by the divine, without naming any names. Even more interesting is the fact that nowhere in the depiction of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, a depiction which explicitly contains carvings of Constantine's various military standards, does the labarum or the chiro or any other kind of cross appear, which is pretty surprising, given the story we've all been told about how Constantine was ordered to conquer in this sign. But the omission of the chiro from the arch, curious as it is, also appears to be the last gasp of Constantine the Dissembler. From here on out, we move pretty decisively over to Constantine the Christian, the man who would one day become, literally, a saint. In the period between his victory over Maxentius and his coming victory over Licinius, Constantine's patronage of Christianity became wider and deeper. He sponsored the building or rebuilding of churches, he exempted clergymen from tax obligations, and, signaling the esteem with which he held the church leadership, when they traveled, he allowed them to use the imperial post, an honor that was reserved only for the most important imperial agents. And beyond that, when the bishops of the Western Empire were convening for the Council of Arles, a council which in and of itself points to Constantine's special interest in the church, he paid for all necessary travel expenses. The emperor still maintained his patronage of pagan philosophers and orators, and was happy to let them sing his praises on their own terms. But clearly, this was a man becoming less and less shy about openly promoting Christianity. And, as I said before, when he declared war on Licinius in 324, the defense of Eastern Christians would form the backbone of his rationale. Not that I found any direct link between the two events, but it is interesting to note that not long after Licinius started harassing Christians again, Constantine accidentally stumbled into the Eastern Augustus's territory at the head of a very large army. The official story is that Constantine had been north of the Danube chasing some hostile Sarmatians, and that they decided to flee southeast and cross the river into Thrace. Constantine couldn't very well let them just get away, so he followed, imaginary boundaries between the emperors be damned. Licinius, of course, took deep offense to Constantine's presence and protested, naturally suspecting that the whole thing was a contrived attempt to suck him back into war. If Constantine was looking to provoke something, though, Licinius refused to take the bait, and the Eastern Augustus stopped short of threatening military action. But Constantine was undeterred, and after a few more years passed, he tried the same trick again, at which point Licinius would be unable to ignore Constantine's aggressive disregard for the terms of their settlement. In the spring of 324, Constantine was once again north of the Danube, either campaigning against the Goths or the Sarmatians, depending on your source, and once again they just happened to flee southeast into Licinius's territory. Once again, Constantine pursued, and once again, Licinius got a message saying that his brother emperor was camped out in Thrace at the head of a very large army. This time, Licinius was livid, and basically told Constantine to get out of his territory or else. This heavy-handed threat was all Constantine needed. Protesting that he was just doing his best to defend the frontier, Constantine announced that this was the last straw. He had stood by and watched as the despised tyrant Licinius, you see what I did just there, had resurrected the evil persecution of the Christians, ignored his imperial responsibilities, and was generally living the life of a debauched villain. Citing in particular Licinius's advanced age and unpopular vices, Constantine declared that it was his moral duty to rid the empire of this imperial cancer. As spring turned to summer, Constantine finally got the war everyone suspected he had been trying to start for years. Both emperors immediately mustered the largest armies they could put together, as it was understood on both sides that there would be no settlement this time around. The troop numbers, while obviously exaggerated, speak to the seriousness with which both men took the coming confrontation. Licinius allegedly gathered 165,000 men, while Constantine led 130,000 of his own. It appears that both men could afford to concentrate such massive forces without weakening the frontiers, because their armies were in large part made up of mercenary forces who would otherwise be the ones the border legions were fending off, Franks for Constantine and Goths for Licinius. In essence, the whole Roman world, friend and foe alike, stopped what they were doing and focused on the coming civil war. In addition to the ground forces, each emperor also assembled a navy. Licinius's was there to protect the crucial Hellespont and Bosphorus crossings. Constantine's was there to seize them. In July of 324, the two sides were ready to have it out. Licinius took up a strong position at Adrianople on the east side of the Hebrus River, now the Maritsa River in Bulgaria. Constantine advanced to meet him and took up his own strong position on the west side of the river. For days, neither commander was willing to make a move. After all, crossing a river directly in front of enemy forces puts you at a considerable tactical disadvantage. But Constantine finally got sick of the staring contest and devised a plan so cunning you could pin a tail on it and call it a weasel. His scouts had identified a good possible crossing point a little ways upstream, so Constantine ordered a division of his men to make a very big show of building a bridge a little ways downstream. Licinius fell for the ruse hook, line, and sinker, and focused all his attention on the decoy construction project. Constantine then personally led an expeditionary force of cavalry and archers across the river at the upstream crossing. They took Licinius's army completely by surprise and caused so much chaos in the enemy ranks that the rest of Constantine's army was able to cross the river unopposed. Once the two forces were on the same side of the Hebrus, the Battle of Adrianople could really get going in earnest. Though they had been taken by surprise, Licinius's army was not just going to roll over, and once the initial shock wore off, they rallied effectively, and just like every other battle between Constantine and Licinius, the fight turned into an evenly matched slugfest. At some point in the battle, one of Constantine's flanks was even being pushed back, but according to legend, he dispatched the Labarum to that corner of the battle, and thanks to its magical properties, Licinius's advance was halted. Once again, the battle lasted until sundown without a decisive conclusion, and once again Licinius, who had lost something like 30,000 men in the fighting, withdrew under the cover of darkness. When morning came, though, Constantine was not able to immediately pursue his rival because it appears that he had been wounded in the previous day's fighting, though the injury was not serious enough to keep him out of action for long. In contrast to his line of retreat following the Battle of Mardia, this time, Licinius headed directly to Byzantium without stopping. Constantine was not going to fall for the same trick twice, so better to just play it safe. Once he got to Byzantium, Licinius followed the same pattern he established following his initial defeat at the Battle of Cybele, and he appointed a man named Sextus Martinianus to the rank of Caesar. It wasn't exactly the same as appointing Valens Augustus, but it had the same effect. A key subordinate's loyalty was secured, and his army had another leader of imperial standing to help share responsibility for the war. After designating some of his troops to act as Byzantium's defense force, Licinius began ferrying the rest of his men across the Bosphorus with all haste, putting Martinianus in charge of the army on the far side. Licinius was confident that the navy he had posted in the Propontis would prevent Constantine's navy from ever entering the Hellespont, but he was not taking any chances. If Constantine's navy were somehow able to seize control of the narrow strait separating Europe from Asia, the Eastern Augustus knew he would be in big trouble. Better to just cross over to Bithynia now and not worry about getting trapped in Byzantium. And it was a good thing he didn't take chances, because the coming Battle of the Hellespont was not going to go well for Licinius's navy at all. While he was gathering his army in the early summer of 324, Constantine had recalled Crispus from the Rhine frontier and ordered him down to the Greek port of Piraeus to take command of the navy assembled there. It was a good-sized fleet, 80 ships in all, but nowhere near the number Licinius had at his disposal. But Crispus, undeterred, sailed out towards the Hellespont anyway. His orders were to seize all the waterways between the Aegean and the Black Sea. When Licinius received word that Crispus was on the way, he ordered 200 of his ships down to blockade the straits of the Hellespont. The idea, of course, was that this force would overwhelm Crispus's smaller fleet. But in the narrow waters of the Hellespont, the larger numbers actually worked against Licinius's admiral. Crispus was able to deftly maneuver around the larger and more constrained enemy fleet, and he inflicted serious damage before Licinius's navy was able to withdraw north to regroup. In the aftermath of the first naval battle, Crispus was reinforced, possibly by ships sailing around from Ravenna. And when he sailed further into the Hellespont to confront Licinius's navy, he now had something like 200 ships at his disposal. Licinius, desperate to prevent the sea lanes from falling into enemy hands, ordered his full force of around 350 ships to go down and sink the son of Constantine. This time, the two navies met near modern Gallipoli, and by all appearances, it looked like the stage was set for a great naval battle. But just prior to the engagement, a storm kicked up that hit Licinius's fleet particularly hard. The ships that were not run aground were badly damaged, and the crews were so battered that when Crispus advanced, the battle turned out to be little more than a mop-up operation. It is reported that only four of Licinius's ships escaped undamaged or uncaptured. The sea now belonged to Constantine. When Licinius found out what had happened, he ordered all the troops in the now indefensible Byzantium to abandon the city and get their butts across the Bosphorus on the double. With Martinianus guarding the coast, Licinius mustered the rest of his remaining troops and tried to figure out what he was going to do next. Constantine, meanwhile, could smell blood in the water and pressed his advantage hard. Using light transports to ferry his men across the Bosphorus, he was able to elude Martinianus and had the bulk of his army across before the new Caesar was able to do anything about it. Licinius then ordered Martinianus to abandon the coast and rendezvous with the rest of the army. Combined, they would make a stand at Chrysopolis, a fortified city a few miles north. But Constantine had guessed their plans, and with all the momentum going with him, he raced north and beat Licinius to the punch. In September of 324, the Eastern Augustus arrived at Chrysopolis, and he found Constantine waiting for him. Here now would be their final battle. Legend has it that at this point, Constantine had gotten so far inside Licinius's head that the Eastern Augustus had become convinced that the Labarum really did have magical properties. He ordered his men to avoid attacking whatever part of Constantine's army carried the standard, and then went even further, ordering his men to not even look at the magical talisman. One gets the feeling that Licinius was, at this point, already beaten. But that being said, the Battle of Chrysopolis was not at all a foregone conclusion. Both emperors were still excellent generals, commanding huge veteran forces. But as happened every time Constantine and Licinius met in the field of battle, eventually the tide turned against the Eastern Augustus. Constantine had not even bothered with clever tactics, and instead went straight for the jugular, ordering a full frontal assault that decisively broke Licinius's line. But Licinius, and oh man, are you as sick of hearing this as I am of saying it, once again managed to slip away, this time with a force of about 30,000 men. He drove headlong for Nicomedia and holed up inside the city, but when Constantine arrived shortly thereafter, it appears that the fight had finally gone out of the Eastern Augustus. Using Constantia as a go-between, the two emperors came to terms. Licinius and Martinianus were to surrender peacefully, and Constantine, giving in to his sister's begging, agreed to let them live. But that was the only concession he was going to make. The empire was now Constantine's and Constantine's alone. For the first time in more than 40 years, Rome was ruled by a single man. The nasty little epilogue to this story which I'll deal with now so we can get it out of the way, is that despite the solemn oath that he swore, it does not look like Constantine had any interest in letting his defeated rivals live. Initially, it appeared that everything was above board, as Licinius was taken to Thessalonica and Martinianus to Cappadocia, where they were both supposed to live out the rest of their days under something like house arrest. But after about a year, Constantine would decide that no one would really care anymore what happened to his beaten rivals, and so he ordered the execution of both. At least, that's what everyone assumed he did. They died under suspicious circumstances, and rumors later swirled that Licinius had been involving himself in a plot to overthrow Constantine, which, frankly, sounds an awful lot like the accusation that Maximian was involved in a plot to overthrow Constantine. And so most modern scholars believe that Constantine simply could not afford to let them live, and so, oath or no oath, he did not let them live. Licinius was about 60 years old and had managed to survive as emperor for a very turbulent 16 years. Constantine also appears at this point to have ordered the execution of his nephew, Licinius the Younger, now maybe 13 years old. We can't have rival dynasties lying around now, can we? Constantine's sister Constantia was, of course, horrified, but it was just business, nothing personal. When Licinius died, the era of the Tetrarchy died with him. Diocletian had done his best to establish a system that would end once and for all the persistent civil wars that had racked the empire in the 3rd century, and instead, he inadvertently had drawn up what amounted to a giant civil war tournament bracket. In the championship game, Constantine finally had emerged victorious. Next time, we will get into the ramifications of his victory. What would Constantine do now that he was the undisputed ruler of the empire? It is a question that will have to wait 2 weeks, though, because, as many of you know, the History of Rome tours begin next Friday, and thus I will have no time to work on new episodes for a while. But fear not, knowing full well that I would be taking this time off, I've been working double time lately, and have managed to get the next 3 episodes written and recorded and ready to go. So in the interest of not just cutting you off for the next 6 weeks, my plan is to remotely post an episode every other week while I'm gone. So that means that there will be a new release on May 15, May 29, and June 12, after which we will resume a normal schedule. I'll say up front that it's my intention to release the episodes on those dates, but given that I have no real idea what my internet situation will be like on any given day, the actual posting time might fluctuate a bit. But rest assured, the episodes are done, ready for your listening pleasure, and I will get them to you in a timely manner. So, live and in-person me will see you in about 6 weeks. Please be nice to pre-recorded me until I get back. And welcome to the History of Rome, episode 137, The Christian Emperor. In the autumn of 324 AD, the Roman Empire awoke to discover that for the first time in 40 years, the empire was ruled by a single man. Only the oldest members of the citizen body even had a memory of what that was like. The rest of the population had grown up in the shadow of Diocletian's Tetrarchy, with its multiple emperors, multiple capitals, and multiple, sometimes conflicting, policies. Now everything, every issue, every decision, every order, was going to be funneled through a single man. Far from shying away from what was, for this generation at least, an unprecedented load of responsibilities, Constantine relished the opportunity he now had to reshape the empire in his own image. Like the greatest of the great Roman leaders who had preceded him, Julius Caesar, Augustus, Hadrian, Diocletian, Constantine came to power full of ideas, full of confidence and full of energy. But more important than all of that, Constantine came to power with the fervent belief that he was the instrument of the Christian God, and it was now his duty to convert Rome to the one true religion. Though the empire would not officially become Christian until the reign of Theodosius, it was right here, in the months after the fall of Licinius, that Constantine made that later switch, just a matter of filing some paperwork. The now sole emperor's first order of business following his victory over Licinius was to parse through his defeated rival's innumerable laws, edicts, and commands to decide which ones would stand and which ones would be tossed out. Constantine and his ministers plowed through everything Licinius had done since taking over the East in 313, and did their best to cancel laws they considered unjust and let stand rulings they thought wise. This was mostly done on a case-by-case basis, but there was one big area where Constantine uniformly rejected Licinius's policy: the status of Christianity. Just so he would not be misunderstood, Constantine wrote an open letter to the people of the eastern provinces, announcing what his policy towards the Christians was going to be. With no one around to challenge him, Constantine could finally stop mincing words, and he announced that not only was Christianity the one true religion, but that, as an institution, the church was going to have the full backing of the imperial government. Right away, it became clear that the emperor was not kidding around. When Constantine and Licinius were first enforcing the Edict of Milan and making sure that church property was returned to its rightful owners, it became standard procedure to compensate families who had come into possession of the seized land or goods. This was a practical measure designed to keep everyone happy. The Christians got their stuff back, and men who had bought the property got a refund. A decent deal all around. But in his letter to the East, Constantine simply announced that, as he was a benevolent man, he would generously pardon any man who he found to be in possession of church property. Pardon. Not compensate. Pardon. As if purchasing some bit of land legally at auction could now be considered a crime. He's kidding about this, right? The revolution only went on from there. In a stark rejection of nearly three centuries of imperial policy, Constantine gave the Christians pride of place, and it was suddenly the pagans who found themselves merely tolerated, pagans who found themselves barred from holding public office, and pagans who found their religious practices banned outright. That last bit was the most radical shift of all. Constantine, at the stroke of a pen, turned his back on God knows how many millennia of tradition, and henceforth forbade divination and sacrifice to the gods. I don't think I have to tell you how big of a deal that was. It is worth noting here, however, that Constantine, despite this radical shift in religious policy, was still a practical man. For the moment, all of this only applied to the East. Though I have no doubt that if he thought he could have done it, he would have buried the old Roman pantheon right then and there. But I think the emperor knew that there were only so many fronts upon which he could fight a war, and stirring up a hornet's nest in the very conservative Senate of Rome right at that moment probably would have done more harm than good. So rather than banning the old Roman cults, the emperor simply quit funding them, choosing instead to underwrite an empire-wide campaign of church building. As the temples of the Eternal City fell into disrepair, magnificent churches sprang up all over the place. Eventually, this building program produced the original St. Peter's, constructed on the supposed site where Peter was crucified in Rome. When the letter to the eastern provinces was published, the negative reaction was immediate, but Constantine refused to back down. He wrote a scathing rebuke of the false and demonic practices of his pagan subjects, and how Christianity, being the only true religion, must become the universal religion of the empire. In attempting to convert a majority pagan population to the minority Christian position, it may seem as if Constantine was fighting an impossible battle. But more than anything else in the Roman world, victory in battle was still the great legitimizer. Were his victories not proof enough that the old gods were a lie, and that the Christian God was the only true God. Constantine's unbroken run of battlefield success was a major argument in his favor. And now that he defined the rules of the game, the citizens of the empire slowly began to fall into line. Ambitious men who wanted to climb the ladder began converting to Christianity. Soldiers who wanted special privileges began converting to Christianity. And average citizens who just didn't want to run afoul of imperial agents began converting to Christianity. Through sheer force of will, Constantine was converting the Roman Empire to Christianity. But of course, right at this moment, just as Constantine was preparing to supplant the traditional cults with the one true religion, the adherents of that one true religion were locked in a mortal death struggle with themselves that threatened to undermine everything Constantine was trying to accomplish. 2 weeks ago, we introduced the Donatist heresy, which, much to Constantine's chagrin, was still fracturing the church in North Africa. This week, we will introduce a heresy that will make the fight over Donatism look like some gentle ribbing between friends. A heresy that will divide the church not just for a generation, but for hundreds of years to come. The Arian heresy. The Arian heresy takes its name from an influential Egyptian priest named Arius, who was born sometime in the 250s AD. At some point, though no one is really sure when, Arius began preaching a very particular interpretation of how God the Father and Christ the Son were related, an interpretation that some of his brothers in the clergy took serious offense to. As with the Donatist heresy, I'm not going to delve too deeply into the issue because it pretty quickly gets pretty esoteric, but the gist of the controversy was this. Arius taught that since Christ was the begotten Son of God, that there must have been a time when Christ was not. Therefore, though both were divine, the Son was inferior to the Father. This line of reasoning contrasted sharply with the beliefs of many in the church, who believed that Father and Son were actually two aspects of the same divine whole, that they were co-substantial, literally of the same substance, with neither one preceding or exceeding the other. Alexander, the conveniently named Bishop of Alexandria, was initially hesitant to make a big deal out of Arius's beliefs, but it soon became clear that this seemingly minor point of philosophic disagreement was dividing the church in two. Bishop Alexander was himself a co-substantialist, so when he finally waded into the controversy, it was to condemn Arianism as heretical. But the bud was too far grown to simply be nipped that easily. Arius's teachings had already spread across the East, and wherever it took root, local Christian communities became divided, as the two sides fought for control of regional bishoprics, local churches, and individual parishioners. This rupture in the unity of the church, just as Constantine was looking to make it the de facto state religion of the empire, really, really annoyed the emperor. But as with the Donatists, he was hesitant to get too involved in the dispute himself. It was an argument over a trivial point of philosophy. Surely the matter could be settled without the emperor needing to get involved. Instead, Constantine dispatched the bishop Osius to Egypt to end the controversy once and for all. Osius was an influential clergyman who had been at Constantine's court since before the Milvian Bridge. To help give him an extra bit of authority, the bishop carried with him a letter from Constantine that did not take a particular stance, but did admonish both sides for making such a big deal out of such a little issue. At least the Donatist controversy dealt with real issues like betrayal and forgiveness, but this Arian controversy, it was all abstract theology. Plus, even in terms of abstract theology, the two sides agreed on like 99 points out of 100. It was just this one little tiny insignificant matter that they disagreed. How in the world could the clergy possibly have allowed it to explode into such a divisive issue? But when Osius got to Alexandria, he failed to broker a deal. He failed in part because the two sides were dug in too deep, but he also failed in part because he did not really want to do what Constantine had sent him to do. The emperor wanted everyone to kiss and make up, and in Constantine's eyes, that meant that any compromise was on the table so long as everyone agreed to it. But it appears that Osius was himself a staunch co-substantialist, who was not looking to compromise with the Arians so much as stamp them out for good. But Osius failed in his own mission as well, and after riots broke out in Antioch over the election of a new bishop, Osius decided to convene a council of Eastern bishops in the Anatolian city of Ancyra to help bring an end to the argument. His idea was that if the Christian establishment condemned the Arians with one voice, that they would finally give up the fight. The council would be billed as an open dialogue that would help the bishop forge a compromise that all could agree to, but Osius had no intention of letting them not forge the correct compromise, if you know what I mean. When he reported back to Constantine, though, the emperor decided that if a wider council was going to be called to settle the matter, that it may as well be a wider council. In fact, let's make it the widest council of all. Let's make it a global council, an ecumenical council, the very first of its kind. Constantine ordered the site of the council be moved to the port city of Nicaea, and then invited all the western bishops to attend as well. The new location would not only make it easier for the bishops of the West to attend, but it would also be close enough to Nicomedia that Constantine himself could pop down and maybe see what he could do to establish the unity that he so craved. Plus, it went without saying that the weather in Nicaea would be much, much better. Though all 1,800 or so bishops in the empire were invited to the council, only around 300 were able to attend the opening of what would in time be called the Council of Nicaea, in May of 325. Though it doesn't seem like a great turnout, with each bishop being allowed to bring along a few priests and deacons to act as aides, the final list of attendees numbered in the thousands. And those aides were not just there to go fetch coffee and take notes for a sleepy bishop. Aside from the emperor, probably the two most important attendees at the council were Arius himself, who was a priest, not a bishop, and a young deacon named Anathasius, who was in the entourage of Bishop Alexander of Alexandria. A hardline anti-Arian, Anathasius made sure the powerful Alexander didn't go all wishy-washy on him. Shortly after the council, the charismatic theologian would succeed Alexander to the bishopric of Alexandria and become a hugely polarizing force within the church. Constantine, as you can imagine, was not the president of Anathasius' fan club. Though the catalyst for the council was the Arian controversy, with so many bishops convening in one place, the church leadership, at the prodding of Constantine, took the opportunity to rule on a whole host of internal disagreements, including when Easter ought to be properly celebrated, what the final status of those who had lapsed during the persecutions ought to be, and what to do about the Milesians, a sect in the East who were seconding the rigorous stance of the Donatists. What Constantine wanted was for the Council of Nicaea to settle all schisms within the church. As I've noted previously, the emperor was not so much interested in which side was right or which interpretation was best, so long as in the end everyone agreed. What record we have of Constantine's role in the deliberations of the council show him repeatedly acting the part of peacemaker, reminding the bishops over and over again that their agreements far outnumbered their disagreements, and that the continued unity of Christianity was of paramount importance. I don't really want to get bogged down in everything the council dealt with, but I do want to settle the Arian question, as it was the main reason everyone was there to begin with. The majority of the bishops in attendance, like the emperor himself, had no strong position on the issue, and were open to any formulation of the father and son's relationship that would resolve the crisis. The opponents of Arianism, led by Osius and Alexander, exploited this fact to the hilt. They had agreed beforehand to frame the debate using particular wording that described the father and the son as being of the same substance, which they knew would be unacceptable to Arius and his followers. The debate that unfolded over the course of the next month was a bitter one, and at one point Arius was even struck in the face by a rival clergyman. Dismayed at the degree of vitriol on display, a group of bishops put forward a compromise creed that described the father and son as being of similar substance, but it was rejected by the hardliners in both camps. More as a result of backroom politicking than persuasive public oratory, the anti-Arians started to flip the delegates one by one, until eventually the same substance formulation was accepted by a majority of the council. Once the majority had turned against them, the moderate Arians began to feel the heat, and with the threat of excommunication and exile hanging over their heads, they too signed on to the same substance creed. In the end, only two of the staunchest Arian bishops refused to sign. The so-called Nicene Creed was adopted by the council as orthodoxy in June of 325. It stated that Jesus Christ was God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of the same substance as the Father, by whom all things were made. Opposition to this formulation was now considered heretical. Arius, just as Osius and his allies had predicted, refused to accept the creed's language and was exiled by Constantine to Illyria, far away from his power base in Egypt. Though the matter appeared to be settled for good, neither Arius nor the Arians were done just yet. The council then moved on to its remaining business and made decisions on how to calculate the date of Easter, what to do about the Milesians, they were to be treated leniently, and what ought to be the church's final position on Traditores. They were to be accepted back without the need for rebaptism. By the end of the meeting in June of 325, the assembled bishops ruled on at least 20, though possibly more, points of canon law. These included the recognition that the bishops of Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch had a sort of super-authority over and above normal bishops, a prohibition on clergy engaging in usury, and a law against self-castration, which, yeah, yikes. All in all, the Council of Nicaea did exactly what Constantine wanted, while simultaneously failing to do what Constantine wanted. The collection of bishops had come together and successfully determined where to draw the line between orthodoxy and heresy on a host of issues. It had given the Christians a new sense of global unity by moving the church away from the patchwork series of beliefs that varied from time to time and from place to place. But if he was hoping the establishment of this new orthodoxy was going to actually end the arguments between the Christians, that men declared heretical were just going to lay down their beliefs and give up the fight, then Constantine was in for a rude awakening. Far from putting these matters to bed, the Council of Nicaea simply wound up codifying the position of one side of the argument. Constantine just did not grasp that the religion he had adopted had never actually been unified. It had appeared to be one monolithic force when it was set against the dominant Greco-Roman culture, but once you actually got into it, it turned out that Christian belief was almost as varied as pagan belief. The Council of Nicaea was not going to stop Arius from preaching what he believed to be true. It was not just a matter of life and death for him, but a matter of eternal salvation. The Donatists, the Milesians, and all the other minor heresies would eventually be stamped out, but the proclamation of a bunch of bishops meeting on the coast of the Aegean Sea was not going to do the job on its own. But as the council wrapped up, Constantine had a pretty good feeling about things, and believed that his vision of one emperor ruling one empire and one church serving one God was close at hand. Next time, we will delve into more worldly matters and discuss what Constantine was up to when he wasn't promoting and defending Christianity. There were, after all, still wars to be fought and a government to run, so it's not like Constantine could just hole up in church councils all the time and debate the finer points of theology. Plus, there was a certain city that needed building. and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 138, The New Rome. So, last time, we focused exclusively on Constantine's relationship with and promotion of Christianity. Obviously, the emperor's push to convert the empire was a hugely important step in the development of the Western world, but it was by no means the only thing he was up to in the years after he became sole ruler of the Roman Empire. There were still wars to be fought, a government to be run, and oh yeah, a whole new Rome to build. So today, I want to dive into all the not overtly Christian aspects of Constantine's reign. I say not overtly Christian because the emperor's religion was so tangled up in everything that he did that you can't just separate it out and say, this stuff has to do with Christianity, and this stuff doesn't. Even something as basic as the construction of Constantinople, which was a project undertaken first and foremost for strategic and political reasons, winds up taking on a heavy Christian dimension. It's inescapable. That was just the nature of the man. They didn't wind up calling him the equal of the apostles for nothing. Speaking of Constantinople, we might as well start there because Constantine broke ground on his new capital practically the morning after he defeated Licinius in September of 324 AD. The rapidity with which he moved to transform the ancient city of Byzantium into the new city of Constantinople speaks to how much thought Constantine had given the project prior to his victory over Licinius. So the questions we must ask are, why did Constantine feel like he needed a new capital, and why did he choose Byzantium for his imperial makeover? As you know, Rome itself had ceased to be the political and military capital of the Roman Empire a long time ago. Round about 260, the emperors had moved decisively away from the Eternal City to more strategically sound locations across the empire. And in the 65 years or so since Gallienus first set up shop in Milan, multiple cities had wound up serving as imperial capitals at one point or another. Trier along the Rhine, Milan in Italy, Sirmium along the Danube, Nicomedia at the crossroads between Europe and Asia, and Antioch in the Far East. But as Constantine surveyed the military and political situation of the empire following his victory at Chrysopolis, no one of these cities really satisfied his vision for what a true imperial capital should be. They all had their merits as regional capitals, but if it was really going to be one emperor ruling one empire, then one capital was called for. Constantine needed a city that was centrally located, easily defensible, situated on the sea with a good harbor, and had easy access to the Danube frontier, which everyone understood to be the most volatile in the empire. Of the existing capitals, Nicomedia was the most obvious candidate to become Constantine's headquarters, and by that point it was already recognized as being one of the preeminent cities of the empire. But the emperor didn't really like that it was located on the east side of the Bosphorus, and while he found the city's defenses adequate, Nicomedia did not necessarily scream, "I am immune to siege." But over the course of his two wars with Licinius, Constantine had become aware of a city that, if upgraded properly, would fit all his conditions for a great capital, Byzantium. Located right on the west bank of the southern entrance of the Bosphorus, Byzantium had a fabulous natural harbor, which meant supply and trade would be no problem. It was also located right smack dab at the crossroads between east and west, which would not only allow the emperor to quickly move to trouble spots, but it would also keep communication lines relatively short, meaning that Constantine would become aware of trouble spots that much quicker. But the coup de grace was that the ancient Greek city was surrounded on three sides by water. This meant that a hostile land army could approach from one direction and one direction only. And if you were to, say, build a massive wall covering that flank, the city would be impregnable. And while the hostile army banged their heads against that wall, the residents of the city could sit tight and enjoy the benefits of infinite resupply by sea. Constantine looked at Byzantium, and it screamed to him, "I am immune to siege." As with everything else he did, though, there was a religious rationale for building a new capital to go along with the obvious military and political rationales. by basically building a brand new city from the ground up. Constantine ensured that he would not have to deal with any pushback from entrenched religious interests when he revealed the fact that his new capital was going to be an exclusively Christian capital. The major cities of the empire, by virtue of being the major cities of the empire, hosted all of the most important cults and temples of the empire. Byzantium, being a relatively minor city up until this point, was not saddled with that kind of pagan baggage. Though the story would not take root for at least a generation, it was widely believed in the Byzantine age that the Christian character of the city was set from the start, and that it was an archangel, visible only to Constantine, who told the emperor where to set the boundaries of the new city. In November of 324, and just a month after his victory over Licinius, Constantine made the short trip from Nicomedia to Byzantium and began eagerly marking up the layout, possibly with the help of an invisible archangel, for what he grandly declared would be the Alterna Roma, the new or second Rome. The name Constantinople, which meant literally the city of Constantine, was at first only an informal nickname for the emperor's pet project. But within a few years, the unofficial name stuck, and it would remain stuck for more than 1,000 years. Constantine planned for the city to be the greatest in the empire, and laid the boundaries and the grid lines accordingly. But Byzantium by no means became Constantinople overnight. At this point in history, Rome was a city of maybe 1 million people. The other big cities of the empire, Alexandria and Antioch and Nicomedia, were filled with populations in the hundreds of thousands. When Constantine began to transform Byzantium, though, it was a city of tens of thousands. In other words, it had a lot of growing up to do if it was really going to compete with the big boys. In a way, the early days of the New Rome parallel the early days of the Old Rome. You'll recall from way back in Episode 2 that the first generation of Romans were a motley bunch. In an effort to populate his city quickly, Romulus had thrown the doors open to anyone who happened by. Beggars, thieves, malcontents, exiles, basically the cast-offs of civilized society. As Byzantium transformed into Constantinople, this new Rome followed a similar pattern. The emperor put out the word that he was looking for men and women and families to come fill up his new capital. But the respectable citizens of the empire were respectable because they had a good thing going right where they were. So the citizens who initially heeded Constantine's call were the struggling, the failed, and the disliked from across the empire who were desperate for a fresh start. This group was augmented by the greedy, the ambitious, and the ruthless, who saw in Constantine's city an opportunity to get in on the ground floor of something really big and make a killing in the process. I think it's safe to say that you would not want to invite Constantinople's first generation of citizens to dinner. As we saw last time, after initiating the process of transforming Byzantium into Constantinople, a process that would take just 6 years, Constantine turned his attention most especially to establishing unity within the Christian church. When the Council of Nicaea wrapped up its business, though, he invited the bishops up to Nicomedia to help him inaugurate his 20th year on the throne, backdating his rule to the death of his father, of course. Antoninus Pius had been the last emperor to serve for more than 20 years, and at just 53 years old and with his health never an issue, Constantine looked poised to set a new standard for longevity. Though in the end he will only be sole ruler for about 12 years, when Constantine died in 337, his 31-year tenure in the purple will rank him second only to the divine Augustus on the all-time list. And speaking of Augustus, after celebrating his anniversary, Constantine made his way over to Aquileia in the spring of 326, and it was here that he decided to follow in the footsteps of that first and greatest of Roman emperors. Unfortunately, the footsteps he decided to follow were the ones that contemporaries and historians alike agree were the biggest missteps of Augustus's career. First up, you remember the ill-fated and overly cruel Lex Julia that sought to legislate sexual morality and failed miserably? Yeah, we're back to that. Second up, You remember how Augustus lashed out at wayward members of his family by exiling them? Well, Constantine is about to outdo the emperor in cold-hearted brutality. Because where Augustus merely exiled members of his family, Constantine is about to kill them dead. Constantine's morality laws followed the Augustan precedent in that they established an idealized model of family life and then rigidly demanded adherence to the model, with draconian punishments doled out to the wayward. The only difference, really, was that Constantine's laws came down particularly hard on women, especially on the issue of premarital virginity, and were rationalized with appeals to Christian scripture rather than appeals to traditional Roman virtue. As with the Augustan attempt to scare everyone straight, though, Constantine's morality laws wound up inflicting punishments on a few unfortunate souls far in excess of their crimes, pouring molten lead down the throat of a servant who aids a couple in eloping? Really? While ultimately having very little impact on how people actually live their lives. It was while he was in Italy in 326 that Constantine then took his second cue from Augustus, and, deciding to do the old boy one better, wound up committing one of the more heinous crimes you can possibly commit. He ordered his eldest son Crispus seized and executed. No one knows exactly why Constantine suddenly turned on his son. That is, what specifically Crispus was supposed to have done. But there is near universal agreement that the emperor's wife Fausta was behind it all. Some people claim Fausta attempted to seduce Crispus and was rejected. Others claim Crispus raped his stepmother in a fit of passion, though this accusation can almost certainly be dismissed, while others simply roll with the old familiar tale of a stepmother looking to get rid of a stepson so that her own children can ascend to the throne. Whatever the reason, she allegedly framed or set up Crispus. The frame-up or set-up job was effective, and the emperor, convinced of something, ordered his boy executed. There is a centuries-old rumor that Crispus fell victim to Constantine's new morality laws, but a far more likely guess is that Crispus was implicated in a plot to overthrow his father. We have no way of knowing if the charges were true, and certainly nothing in Crispus's life or career even hint that he planned to turn on his father, but as that great military philosopher Saul Tai once said, no one is a traitor until they are. So, who knows? The consensus, though, is that Crispus was framed, and most likely framed by Fausta. Certainly what happens next does not bode well for her historical reputation. After Crispus was executed, the imperial court moved down to Rome, where it was joined by Constantine's mother Helena, who had been living in the city since her son's victory at the Milvian Bridge. Shortly after the emperor's arrival, Helena appears to have met privately with Constantine to discuss the circumstances of her grandson's death. We don't know exactly what proof she presented to Constantine, but it apparently convinced him that his lovely wife had just tricked him into murdering his own son, because straight away he had Fausta seized and put under guard. Then, torn by an understandable mix of grief and rage, he decided that an eye for an eye was the best way to go. The most commonly told version of the story is that he had his wife put in a steam room, the doors were locked, and the heat was cranked up to 11. The empress suffocated in the unbearable heat. Just like that, the emperor's son and wife were both dead, and both were dead at the emperor's hand. Even in the far more permissive ancient world, these were serious crimes that would haunt Constantine for the rest of his life. The emperor remained in Rome for a time, and then began a slow journey back to Nicomedia. Well aware that he had maybe screwed up pretty royally, and that his reputation was going to suffer, especially in the Christian circles who tended to look sideways at things like murdering members of your own family, Constantine sought to minimize the damage, and maybe change the subject by sending his mother Helena on a religious pilgrimage to the Far East. She was sent to identify key locations in the life of Jesus, initiate construction of any shrine she felt appropriate, and wherever she went, to liberally spread the imperial wealth. In other words, she was on a goodwill mission to help head off any tarnishing of Constantine's image. The mission succeeded beyond the emperor's wildest expectations, and his mother's tour of the East which, among other things, officially determined the site of both Jesus' birth and his death, built a number of important churches that stand to this day, and then came home with pieces of the true cross, inspired thousands and then millions to follow in her footsteps and make a pilgrimage to what was now starting to be known as the Holy Land. Like her son, she is not known as Saint Helena for nothing. With the heat from this double murder partially deflected, Constantine was able to get back to the business of being emperor without suffering too much for his crime. The questions I want to spend the rest of this episode on, then, are, aside from his promotion of Christianity, what kind of emperor was Constantine, and what role did he play in the evolution of the empire? In general, the answer is that he was, in almost every way, the ideological heir of the old senior Augustus Diocletian. There were differences, of course, the biggest being that Constantine had no truck with the division of imperial labor, but other than that, we see him continuing Diocletian's policies, and refining Diocletian's policies, and extending Diocletian's policies. But only rarely do we see him turning away from Diocletian's policies. Despite the failure of the Tetrarchy, in the end, most of what Diocletian put in place wound up defining the next few centuries of the empire's evolution. Even Constantine, radical, visionary Constantine, appears to have seen no reason to fundamentally change much of anything at all. First off, Constantine completely bought into the ideology of the emperor as the divinely appointed ruler, and fully embraced the pageantry that Diocletian had built up to elevate the emperor above mortal men, though obviously Constantine looked to God rather than Jupiter as his ultimate patron. Constantine dressed exquisitely, wore a diadem, remained sequestered from all but the most important dignitaries, sat while others stood, and was addressed as Lord Constantine, or Sacred Constantine, or Divine Constantine. Diocletian had redefined the role of the emperor in the empire, and Constantine played the new part to perfection. But it was not just in the optics department that Constantine followed Diocletian's lead. In the realm of imperial administration, he followed the old senior Augustus as well. He made only minor tweaks to the reform provincial divisions Diocletian had established. Military and civilian careers were kept separate, and real power was increasingly shifted to the emperor's ever-expanding central bureaucracy. Constantine added new positions and new layers to the already elaborate governmental apparatus he inherited, and did everything he could to enhance the dignity and cement the authority of the imperial bureaucrats. His only break with Diocletian in this regard is that Constantine was not so eager to thumb his nose at the senatorial class, especially since he was in the middle of an all-out assault on their religious beliefs. Following through on the promise he had made following the Milvian Bridge to renew their old privileges, Constantine reopened most of the higher offices in the empire to men of senatorial rank, and eagerly welcomed them into his administration. He coupled this reform with a deliberate move to reduce the number of equites serving in government. Now, this appears to be a pretty significant shift in policy, but there was actually less to it than meets the eye. Because though Constantine opened up all these positions to men of senatorial rank, he also significantly lowered the bar for admission into that class. In effect, all those equites who were now barred from this office or that post didn't really care, because, hey, look at me, I'm a senator now too. When Constantine enrolled a new senate to serve him in Constantinople, it did not number 300 or even 600, but 2,000. The senatorial class was welcomed back into power, sure, but only after Constantine had carefully watered it down. Constantine also continued with Diocletian's almost scientific approach to taxation, though when coupled with his monetary policy, Constantine really did a number on Diocletian's vision of everyone sharing in the burden of empire according to their particular means. Though for the most part Diocletian's tax structure continued to function as it previously had, Constantine began pushing to augment the in-kind system with new taxes that were to be paid in precious metal, just like the good old days. The political and economic systems of the empire had stabilized considerably since Diocletian had initiated his tax reforms, and Constantine felt like it was time for his subjects to start paying in cash again. This move was coupled with the emperor's introduction of a carefully crafted gold coin called the solidus, 72 of which were to equal 1 Roman pound. Though no one knew it at the time, the soundness of the solidus would become legendary, as its weight and purity would be maintained for the next 700 years at least, forming the basis of the Byzantine economy and almost single-handedly helping to keep the West from falling into a strictly barter economy following the fall of the empire. But unfortunately, Constantine focused only on the gold standard, and he basically left silver and copper coins to fend for themselves, which helped to exacerbate the growing divide between the rich and everyone else. Those rich enough to deal in gold found that their wealth and power was now shielded from the ravages of runaway inflation, while those further down the ladder, in particular the middle-class merchants, once again saw their lives and livelihoods threatened by an unstable economy. The most pernicious aspect of Constantine's new gold and silver tax, which was directed primarily at the commerce of the merchant class, was that it was only assessed once every 4 years. That is, the collectors would come around and demand a lump sum of what you owe to cover the next 4 annual budgets. You can imagine how much stress this would cause us today, and we have automatic withholding. For a population also dealing with runaway inflation, the new tax was a disaster. What money they had was virtually worthless, and nowhere near enough to cover the patently absurd demands that were now being laid down from on high. So every 4 years, the citizens of the empire would have a collective panic attack as they tried to figure out how in the hell they were going to pay the tax collectors. And of course, since the tax collectors themselves were on the hook if they did not meet their quota for revenue, well, let's just say that exceptions were never made, and eventually Constantine had to step in and publish edicts banning the more sadistic forms of torture. It was not at all uncommon during this quadrennial nightmare for children to be sold into slavery to pay tax debts, or for households to simply give up and become indentured servants to wealthy landowners when they were unable to pay. Constantine was not indifferent to the problems of his new tax system, and over the years he did his best to make sure tax obligations lined up with the citizens' actual ability to pay. But the long and short of it was that he needed the money, and sometimes you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. So, what was the omelet Constantine was trying to make? That is, why did he need all of that money? The emperor, of course, had an army to pay for and frontiers to defend, which we'll talk about more next time. He also had a bureaucracy to pay for and a government to run. He also had initiated an empire-wide building program that was unprecedented in its size and scope, at least in the context of its time. And that building program, though dominated by church construction, St. Peter's, for example, was a hugely expensive undertaking. Constantine did not ignore the secular infrastructure, and he did his best to help cash-strapped municipalities keep their public buildings from falling into disrepair. And of course, there was the city he was building on the Bosphorus, which was officially inaugurated in May of 330 AD, but which remained a persistent drain on the treasury as the emperor got his city up and running. All of this added up to a very large number on the bottom line, and it is actually much to Constantine's credit that he was at least mindful of the fact that at the end of the day, the credits and debits ought to line up. Tax and spend might be bad, but tax cut and spend is even worse. Plus, while Constantine could never be accused of being frugal, neither could he be accused of being mindlessly extravagant. Everything he did had a point, and for the most part, that which Constantine paid for was well worth the cost. That said, his handling of the economy, and his monetary policy in particular, inflamed problems that would, in time, lead to nothing less than the fall of the Western Empire. For example, one of the most interesting side effects of the commercial tax was that large landowners were able to avoid paying it simply by making their estates as self-sufficient as possible. No trade, no tax. Along with a number of other factors, this increased self-sufficiency allowed the super elites to begin withdrawing from public life altogether, undermining the imperial system, and creating little independent fiefdoms that would in time form the backbone of feudal Europe. And that's the problem with these things. Sometimes you don't know what the final cost is going to be. Next time, we will cover the last years of the man history will come to know as Constantine the Great. With his heir apparent Crispus now dead, the aging emperor will have to quickly bring his younger sons up to speed so that the empire would not be left in the hands of novices when he was gone. Pressures in the north will plunge him and the empire back into war, and a crisis in the east will very nearly lead to armed conflict with the Persians. And of course, at the very end, and with no time left for any further sin to stain his soul, Constantine, the first Christian emperor, will finally be baptized. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 139, Wash Away Your Sins. Last time, we talked about what Constantine got up to when he wasn't busy trying to convert the empire to Christianity. You'll recall that for the most part, he was up to refining the administrative apparatus Diocletian had created, transforming Byzantium into Constantinople, and, killing his wife and son. This week, we will bring the long and remarkable career of the first Christian emperor to a close. But before we do, I want to spend some time discussing the external posture of the empire during Constantine's reign. Last time, we focused mostly on domestic concerns, taxes and monetary policy and so on. So this week, I want to take a look at foreign affairs. What was Constantine's relationship with the tribes beyond the northern frontiers? What was his relationship with the great Sassanid Empire beyond the eastern frontiers? And of course, what was his relationship with the army that defended those frontiers? Once we get done talking about all that, we're going to turn our attention to the thorny issue of succession, and then finally, to the baptism and death of Constantine the Great. As we've discussed previously, during the later Roman Empire, the hard line separating the civilized Romans from the barbarian tribes began to blur. Imperial policy had always hinted at the possible benefits of bringing the Germans into the Roman fold, and round about the reign of Aurelian, that hint became a blunt statement, as willing tribesmen, suitably pacified, started to be deposited in Gaul or Pannonia or Moesia to help fill the empty quarters and provide a buffer between the soft inner empire and the hard northern wilds. These same tribesmen were then recruited into the army, and by virtue of the fact that the legions were a far more merit-based institution in the late empire than it was in the early empire, they began to climb up the chain of command. This so-called Germanization of the army is a very important development in the history of the empire, a development which we will come back to again and again as the West slips into terminal decline. Because any discussion of why the Western Empire fell would be incomplete without a good hard look at the Roman failure to successfully integrate the Germans, the way they had successfully integrated practically every other foreign people they had run up against in the whole long history of the empire. By virtue of the circumstances of his times and the circumstances of his own political situation, Constantine wound up becoming an acolyte of Germanization. His father, as you'll recall, had gotten his imperial start fighting wars with and making peace with the tribes along the Rhine River. So when Constantine succeeded him, the son inherited the political and military legacies of the father. Constantius had embraced the policy of German settlement within the borders, and in particular, he had a strong relationship with the Franks on the lower Rhine. Indeed, one of the great successes of his career was defeating a portion of the Franks who were aligned with Carausius and then flipping them over to his side. When Constantius died 10 years later and Constantine made his bid for power, he was backed at a critical moment by the Frankish clients his father had cultivated. From that moment on, Constantine had a close relationship with the Germans in general and the Franks in particular. They formed the most formidable parts of the armies he used to conquer the empire, and his own personal bodyguard was made up exclusively of German cavalry. This is, of course, not to say that the Germans were one monolithic thing, and that Constantine was friendly with them all, nor that they were all friendly with him. One look at the innumerable campaigns fought along the Rhine during the length of Constantine's career is enough to dispense with that notion. But that said, the incorporation of Germanic elements into the empire's military apparatus was now on the steady rise, and Constantine was a big reason why. Besides his willingness to fight using German soldiers, there was one other change Constantine made to the military structure that wound up having long-term consequences for the empire. You'll recall that back in episode 125, The Best Defense is a Good Defense, I mentioned the difficulty in trying to figure which of the period's military reforms were actually initiated by Diocletian due to the presence of possible anachronisms in the historical record. Specifically, I was talking about the creation of the Limitanei, the frontier militias who would act as a first line of defense until the legions proper could arrive on the scene. Well, we can stop worrying about anachronisms now, because in the reign of Constantine, the existence of the Limitanei is definitely attested to, and those who are loath to attribute the creation of it to Diocletian are hesitant to do so because they believe it was actually Constantine who initiated the change, and that he did so as a way to make up for the fact that he was now deploying the empire's legionary forces much further behind the frontier lines. He is said to have done this in order to create large mobile field armies that would be able to easily reach an invasion point along the border and then overwhelm any hostile forces they found. But these days, there is a large contingent of historians who suspect that Constantine concentrated his forces and garrisoned them in interior cities for domestic political reasons. More than any commander since perhaps Octavian, Constantine's career was dominated by civil war, and it is not unreasonable to assume that his military posture was heavily influenced by that experience. To help him run the vast new army he now had sole control of, an army numbering somewhere between 400 and 600,000 men, Constantine created two new ranks, the Master of the Infantry and, resurrecting the long-ago abandoned title of a dictator second-in-command, the Master of the Horse. As the title suggests, one was supposed to be in control of the empire's foot soldiers and the other in charge of the empire's cavalry, thus allowing for large-scale coordination without investing either man with sole control over all the forces in a region. But in practice, both of these high-ranking officers wound up commanding elements of the other's administrative sphere. Plus, in time, both of these ranks would become subservient to an overall master of the military, who acted as the commander-in-chief of the whole army, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of the foot-horse distinction. In and of themselves, these new positions are not that interesting, as they simply filled the void left by the Praetorian prefects once their military powers were stripped away. But the role the men who held these offices would play in the final century and a half of the Western Empire is fascinating indeed. Essentially, denied the right to hold political power in their own right, the powerful German officers who served as masters of the military in the 5th century would become the power behind a series of puppet emperors. And eventually, the imperial office itself would be weakened to the point that when it was abolished by Otto Asser in 476, it went not with a bang, but a whimper. But we'll get to all of that soon enough. Constantine's reforms to the military worked out pretty well for the emperor at the time. But eventually, they became the source of some of the harshest criticisms of his reign. By pulling the stronger, faster, and better-trained troops off the frontiers, the feeling was that he was fatally weakening the borderlands and leaving them far more vulnerable than they needed to be. Plus, By dropping huge garrisons in the cities of the interior, those cities were suddenly dealing with the burden of feeding and housing all of these troops. Far from the front lines, the soldiers grew soft, and the citizens became embittered. Morale suffered all around, and that old disconnect between the armed forces and the civilian population was revived with a vengeance. Finally, though there are many ways to look at the issue, Constantine's willingness to populate the legions with soldiers of German descent and augment his armies with German auxiliary forces was seen as a crucial development in the story of how the Western Empire fell. Because, the theory goes, once the Germans wormed their way into the military, the ultimate destruction of the empire became a matter not of if, but of when. But like I say, the reforms worked pretty well at the time. And for the 12 years he was sole emperor, the legions won every single campaign they initiated. And they initiated a lot. Mostly against the Franks and the Alemanni on the Rhine, and the Sarmatians and Goths along the Danube. In fact, after being pushed back by the barbarians during the crisis of the 3rd century, the Romans finally, consistently, found themselves having the upper hand in their dealings with the northern menace. Things went so well that Constantine actually felt comfortable building a permanent bridge across the Rhine, and repairing the bridge that Trajan had once built and Aurelian had torn down that crossed the Danube. There was even a brief period in the early 330s when the Romans reoccupied Lower Dacia. Aware that his execution of Crispus had left him without an experienced heir, Constantine began handing all of these wars off to his younger sons to season them up a bit. None of them were quite old enough to hold down a command of their own, but they were put in nominal charge and told to stick close of the capable generals actually running things and learn everything they could as fast as they could. In 330, Constantine II earned the title Alemannicus, and in 332, at the age of 15, he fought in a successful war against the Goths. Constantius II, meanwhile, was sent to acquaint himself with the eastern provinces, and had there actually been a war with Persia, which we'll get to in a second, he certainly would have found himself right smack dab in the middle of it. Constantine's youngest son, Constans, was still just a child during the latter part of his father's reign, but he was made Caesar in 333, and likely would have followed his older brothers had the emperor lived. The implications of all this began to become clear. Constantine was not favoring one son over any of the others, and it appeared that the emperor expected all three of them to succeed him to power in the spirit, if not the form, of the Tetrarchy. If Constantine's redeployment of the empire's military forces raises eyebrows among scholars, then his succession plan makes them bang their heads against the wall. I don't think in all my research I have read a single good thing about how Constantine chose to leave the imperial house when he died. Had Crispus lived, it is probable that Constantine would have passed the throne directly to his eldest son, who was both a proven leader and eminently capable. But after, you know, murdering him, Constantine was left with a pile of sons and nephews, all of whom were young, all of whom were relatively inexperienced, and none of whom really stood out against the others. So Constantine decided to just leave the empire to the whole lot of them, and let them figure it out for themselves. Constantine II was to receive the western provinces, Constantius II the eastern provinces, Constans, Italy, and Pannonia. One step-nephew, a man named Dalmatius, was to receive Thrace, Macedonia, and Achaia. And another, Hannibalianus, was to have some sort of vague authority over the far eastern borderlands. Had the sons of Constantine been paragons of virtue and filled with fraternal love, the arrangement might have worked. But unfortunately, they had all grown up in the shadow of their father, a man who had spent his entire life ruthlessly dispatching members of his own family in order to demolish a carefully arranged power-sharing agreement. Over the years, he had killed his father-in-law, three brothers-in-law, one nephew, his son, and his wife, all in the name of securing and maintaining sole control of the Roman Empire. His sons learned this lesson well, And if Constantine thought that they were not going to follow in his footsteps, then he was blind, or he was crazy, or both. More than a few people have accused him of simply being so egomaniacal that he just didn't care what happened after he died. We'll get into it more next week, but suffice it to say that Constantine had raised a basket full of vipers, and it took them about 7 seconds to turn on each other once the old man was gone. Which brings us to one of Constantine's last and most controversial initiatives. At some point between 334 and 336 AD, the emperor got it into his head that he was going to provoke a war with Persia. Why he thought this would be a good idea, especially since the legions were bogged down on both the Rhine and Danube frontiers, remains a mystery. But there you have it. The groundwork for the war had been laid at some point after he defeated Licinius, when the emperor sent a strongly worded letter to the Sassanid king, informing him that Constantine considered the Christians in Sassanid territory to be his clients, and that he would have no qualms about taking any necessary steps to ensure their safety. The Sassanid king did not miss the fact that this was pretty much exactly the same line of thinking that Constantine had just used to pick a war with Licinius. Tensions were kept to a low simmer until the mid-330s, when Constantine decided to confer upon his step-nephew, Hannibalianus, the title King of Kings of the Pontic People, which was basically the equivalent of the Sassanid king appointing someone emperor of the Roman people. In other words, pretty provocative stuff. So the Persians got a little paranoid, especially about the Christian king of Armenia, who they now saw as a part of a larger plan to encircle and conquer them. So, probably in 336, the Sassanid king invaded Armenia and deposed the Christian king, which could not have played more into Constantine's hands, and the old emperor began to gear up for one last great campaign. But he would never make it out of Bithynia. Not long after Easter 337, the emperor fell ill and left Constantinople to recover at the hot baths near the city of Helenopolis, named for the emperor's mother. After a short visit to the Turkish coast, Constantine realized that he was not going to recover, and he tried to make it back to Constantinople so he could die in the city he had created. But he was only able to make it as far as the suburbs of Nicomedia. Knowing that the end was near, Constantine summoned the bishop of Nicomedia to formally baptize him. People often expressed surprise and wonder at the fact that the first Christian emperor was not baptized until moments before his death, and a cynical reading often results. Usually that reading goes something like this: the emperor never was a true Christian, and even now was just hedging his bets. But there is another reading that I often find more compelling. Constantine was a true believer who was really, really afraid of the Lord our God. It was not uncommon at the time to believe that baptism washed away all your accumulated sins and basically left you with a blank moral slate. If you truly believed then that too much sin would hurt your ability to make it into heaven, it is only logical to wait until the last possible moment to get baptized. That way, you would go in clean as a newborn babe. It was a dangerous game because, hey, what if you get run over by an ox cart? But it was a game that Constantine evidently played and won, because in the few days between his baptism and his death, he didn't murder a single one of his family members. So, pure as a fresh mountain stream, on May the 22nd, 337 AD, Constantine the Great died. He was 65 years old and had been an emperor for almost 31 years. Constantine was a strong political leader, indisputably the greatest general of his age, and a visionary who transformed the religious and cultural life of the empire like no emperor before him. Before he rose to power, Christianity was a religion being hunted down like a criminal, and when he died, Rome was so far down the road to conversion that Julian the Apostate's attempt to turn back the tide simply confirmed how much Constantine had entrenched his new religion. Beyond that epoch-shifting feat, he also built a new capital on the Bosphorus, that quite literally became the most important city in the world for 1,000 years. But these great, truly great achievements were offset by a darker set of legacies. And when the critiques of Constantine's military reforms are coupled with his handling of the Sassanids and his handling of the succession issue, what we are left with is a great emperor with a mixed record. Because one of the major questions we must ask when assessing an imperial career is, did he leave the empire stronger and safer than he found it? In Constantine's case, it is not uncommon to hear scholars and historians say, well, no, he did not. His new gold standard served to stabilize the economy, yes, but only for the upper classes. The rest of the citizen body was left scrambling to keep up in a world of runaway inflation. Mostly they could not keep up, and the roots of medieval feudalism with its serfs and its lords is not too difficult to detect. His inexplicable desire to start up a war with the Sassanids would leave his heirs tied to an unnecessary conflict with the Persians for years that would cost men and resources and at least one emperor that Rome really couldn't spare. And, of course, his ill-conceived dynastic plans all but guaranteed a return to the dark days of civil war. Constantine the Great was a great emperor, and easily one of the most important figures in all of world history. But despite the key role he played in the evolution of the West, we should not forget that he was also a flawed man who was fully capable of making bad choices that his heirs paid for in blood and treasure. Some would even go so far as to trace the fall of the Western Empire right to his doorstep. Gibbon's whole thesis, for example, was that Christianity was a malignant cancer that eventually killed the empire. I wouldn't go that far, because nothing Constantine did guaranteed a catastrophe of that magnitude, and some of the things he did, like furthering the Germanization of the army, only turned out to be bad ideas in retrospect because of how his successors handled the issue, not because they were inherently bad ideas. Constantine was a complicated man who lived in and utterly dominated complicated times. Whatever your view of the man, noble Christian saint or reckless theocratic tyrant, he changed the course of world history, and for that reason alone, we will never, ever stop talking about him. Next week, we will stop talking about Constantine. Instead, alive and in-person me will be back to discuss the bloody struggle that erupted between his sons and nephews the minute the emperor was dead. It would take 13 years of strife, backstabbing, and discord before the empire was once again united under a single man, the craftiest and ruthless of all Constantine's heirs, Constantius II. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 140, My Three Sons. Well, live and in-person me is back. As you know, the History of Rome just spent the last 5 weeks bouncing back and forth between Italy and Turkey on the official History of Rome, Roman History Tour. It was an absolutely fantastic time, and the answer is yes, we are planning to do it again, and the sooner the better. That said, there's nothing I hate more than beating around the bush, so let's get back into this thing. It's been 6 weeks since I last thought about the show, and I'm dying to find out what happens next. But there are two minor corrections I need to get out of the way before we can get on with it. First, alert listener Anthony caught me accidentally reversing syllables in episode 137, so the polarizing deacon who later became the polarizing Bishop of Alexandria should have been Athanasius, not Athanasius. Sorry about that. The second mistake is from episode 138 and is quite a bit more embarrassing. See, what happened is that I had just gotten Mrs. The History of Rome into the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, so we were pretty much watching it nonstop. At the same time, I personally also happened to be watching a lot of the HBO Rome series. Do you see where this is going? Unfortunately, despite my clear memory to the contrary, Saul Tai never did say, "No one is a traitor until they are." Although it really, really sounds like something he might say. In reality, Titus Pulo said it. He said it in Rome, Season 2, Episode 8, A Necessary Fiction. Alert listener Nick mentioned in the comment thread that he remembered Pulo saying something just like that, and I immediately knew I had botched the reference. It was an honest mistake in a time of great stress, and I hope that you will all forgive me. Okay, now that all the old business has been dispensed with, unless there are any objections, let's move on to new business. We left off last time with the death of Constantine on May 22, 337 AD. This week, I want to cover how his sons handled the fact that they were now in charge of the empire. As we will see, they will quickly prove that they are every bit their father's sons. It is difficult to pinpoint exactly where the boys were at the moment of their father's death, but it appears that Constantine II, the eldest of the three at 21 years old, was in the far west, perhaps even as far off as Trier. Constance, the youngest of the three at somewhere between 14 and 17 years old, was likely in Pannonia or northern Italy, while the middle son, 20-year-old Constantius II, was in the far east, readying for a campaign against the Sassanids. Of the three sons, Constantius will prove to be the most cunning, decisive, and ruthless of them all, and this became apparent right from the very beginning. Dropping everything, he rushed back to Constantinople and took it upon himself to immediately oversee the funeral and burial of the dead emperor before either of his brothers could arrive and share in the prestige of presiding over an imperial funeral. Savvy play. And he was just getting warmed up. Now, as we discussed last week, Constantine had laid out a fairly detailed succession scheme that involved splitting up the empire between his three sons and two of his nephews, Dalmatius and Hannibalianus. The latter was to hold some vague authority over the eastern borderlands, while the former was to be granted control of Thrace, Macedonia, and Achaia, which is to say, Dalmatius was to be in charge of Constantinople itself. Scholars have surmised that Constantine was attempting to set up a sort of neutral zone around the capital so that no one of his sons would be able to claim it as their own and thus throw the balance of power out of whack. But boy, was that ever not what happened at all. About 10 minutes after Constantine was laid to rest, Constantius II initiated what has since been dubbed the Massacre of the Princes, which was, yeah, exactly what it sounds like it was, a massacre of princes. To fully appreciate what Constantius II is about to do, we must unfortunately turn for a second to the insanely convoluted Constantinian family tree, which I can assure you is every bit as confusing as the Julio-Claudian family tree. I'll admit that as I parse my way through the twists and turns of Constantine's extended family, I secretly began to thank Constantius II for killing half of them off in May 337 just because of how much it simplifies everything. As with the Julio-Claudians, there were two main branches to the family that were often at subtle odds with each other. On one side, there were the descendants of Constantius and Helena, which is to say, Constantine the Great and his children. And on the other were the descendants of Constantius and Maximian's daughter Theodora. Constantius's second marriage eventually produced three sons and three daughters, giving Constantine a raft of half-brothers and sisters to deal with. You'll no doubt recall that one of these half-sisters, Constantia, was married to Licinius, and another, Anastasia, was married to the ill-fated Bassianus, who Constantine executed on trumped-up treason charges as he was preparing a case for war against Licinius. The third sister, Eutropia, wound up giving birth to a boy named Nepotianus, which is noteworthy for two reasons. First, he will show up briefly in 350 AD running a counter-usurpation against Magnentius. And second, that means that he survived the massacre of the princes. despite all the talk about how Constantius Gallus and Julian were the only males from the Theodorus side of the family to make it out alive. Probably he is little noted because he was the son of one of Constantine's sisters rather than one of Constantine's brothers, so with patriarchal rules applying, he just isn't considered that relevant. As for Constantine's half-brothers, the eldest, Flavius Dalmatius, had at least two sons that we know about, and, coincidentally enough, two sons that you know about too, the aforementioned Dalmatius and Hannibalianus, who were favored enough by Constantine to be brought into his succession scheme. The second brother, Julius Constantius, gave birth to two sons and a daughter with his first wife, and another son with his second wife. Now, I normally wouldn't bother getting that deep into all of this, but the thing is that of all the males on the Theodora side of the family, not counting Nepotianus, of course, only the youngest sons of Julius Constantius will manage to survive the massacre of the princes. 11-year-old Constantius Gallus and 5 or 6-year-old Flavius Claudius Julianus, the future emperor Julian the Apostate. So sorry for throwing all of this mind-numbing lineage at you, but I wanted to at least introduce these boys, so you know how exactly they come by their future imperial dignities. The last of Constantine's half-brothers was an elder Hannibalianus, who was probably dead by this point, so just forget about him. He will not be on the test. Over the course of his reign, Constantine had brought in all of these half-brothers and sisters into his imperial system, doling out key assignments to the brothers and key marriages to the sisters. Constantius and Theodora had started up their family about 20 years after Constantine had been born. So when the emperor kicked the bucket in 337, all of these brothers and sisters were in their late 30s and early 40s. In other words, entering the prime of their lives, ready, willing, and able to take on a greater role in government and help steer the fortunes of the next generation, the generation that had been granted formal authority by Constantine. But Constantius II had no interest in playing nice with the other children. With the whole of Theodora's extended family present in Constantinople for the funeral, Constantius II saw an opportunity to secure undisputed power for himself and his brothers, and he took it. Though the details are sketchy, it appears that over the course of one or two bloody days, Constantius ordered his uncles and cousins seized and executed. Their alleged crime? Nothing less than the assassination of Constantine the Great. Some contrived evidence was put forth to support the charge, but other than that, there was nothing resembling due process. All in all, 9 men from Theodora's side of the family were killed, and this of course included Dalmatius and Hannibalianus, the young men who were supposed to share power with Constantius and his brothers. As I just said, not counting Nepotianus, of course, young Constantius Gallus and Julian were the only ones spared, due entirely to the fact that they were merely children. But don't worry, Gallus too will eventually join his family by dying at Constantius' order in 354. In the end, only Julian will survive Constantius' wrath, and it's possible that was only because Constantius died before he could get around to killing Julian. So far as I can tell, Constantine's middle son faced no long-term repercussions for having ordered a purge of his extended family, and the empire simply accepted that that was the way things went sometimes. That, and whoever might be inclined to dissent, just got put on notice that maybe criticizing the new emperor was bad for your health. Before we move off this, though, I should mention that there is another version of all this that depicts Constantius as merely allowing the massacre to happen rather than ordering it himself. That is, the palace troops detested Theodora's side of the family so much that they were just itching to murder them all, and when Constantine died, Constantius II simply allowed their passions to run wild. But given every other paranoid and ruthless thing he did with his life, I am not at all opposed to laying blame squarely at the young prince's doorstep. It is in perfect keeping with all of Constantius's later tendencies. His two brothers, for their part, did not seem at all concerned about the massacre, and when the three of them met a few months later in Sirmium, They did not engage in any hand-wringing over the murders, so much as focus intently on how best to divide the empire between them. The map they agreed to adhered mostly to their father's boundary lines, with Constantine II receiving the far western provinces of Gaul, Britannia, Hispania, and Mauritania, Constantius holding all of the eastern provinces plus Thrace, which means he gets Constantinople, another savvy play, and Constans holding Italy, Illyria, Macedonia, Achaia, and the Middle African provinces. However, since he was no older than 17 at this point, and possibly as young as 14, Constans was forced to accept that Constantine II would be his guardian and hold a super authority over his territories until young Constans came of age. The youngest of Constantine's sons was no doubt annoyed by this, but he gave in, knowing that he would not have to wait long to be considered their equal. After all, his brothers were only 21 and 20, respectively. In other words, not really much older than he was right then, so it's not like they were going to be bossing him around for long. Emerging from the meeting, the three sons of Constantine were officially hailed as co-Augusti by the assembled troops, and then they marched off to govern their respective provinces. For Constantius, this meant heading straight for the Syrian border. You'll recall from last week that in the final years of his reign, Constantine inexplicably began to provoke a war with the Sassanids, which, as you can imagine, they did not take kindly to. Now that some untested punks were in charge of the empire, the Persians decided that now was a pretty good time to punch the Romans in the nose and maybe remind them why détente in the east was far preferable to war. So they started attacking Roman positions, and off Constantius went to try to stop them. We don't have a particularly good record of the subsequent campaign, but it appears that in the beginning at least, Constantius was repeatedly beaten and forced to scramble around a bit before he was able to find his sea legs, although nothing resembling a decisive encounter ever took place. Meanwhile, back in the west, Constantine II set up court in Trier and began surveying the territory that he now controlled. But when he surveyed the territory he now controlled, he quickly became convinced that he had been shortchanged. I'm not sure why he didn't just speak up during the meeting in Sirmium when this was all being hashed out to begin with, but he didn't, and so it's not until the winter of 337-338 that we begin to hear Constantine complaining that he deserved a bigger share of the empire because, after all, he was the oldest brother. One possible explanation is that Constantine was under the impression that he would be able to dominate Constance forever, and so he had mentally lumped his youngest brother's territory in with his own. But after learning that Constance had no intention of being dominated by anyone, Constantine suddenly decided he wanted more territory to call explicitly his own. So he demanded that Constance immediately cede all the African provinces. This request was naturally met with some pushback by young Constans, but not so much at this point that war between the two brothers was inevitable. They agreed to meet later in 338 to discuss the situation. In between coming to power in the summit with Constans, there was one matter of consequence that Constantine II weighed in on, and it has to do with our old friend Athanasius. After bursting onto the scene as a fierce anti-Arian deacon during the run-up to the Council of Nicaea, Athanasius had since succeeded Alexander to the bishopric of Alexandria, ignoring age requirements and proper electoral procedure to get there, by the way, and then he used his new powers to come down hard on those who strayed from the Nicene orthodoxy. His methods were often denounced by his enemies within the church, and by 335, he was more or less dragged in front of Constantine the Great to answer a laundry list of charges, including destruction of church property and the murder of a rival bishop. Athanasius wound up being cleared of all the charges, except for an alleged threat he had made to cut off the Egyptian grain supply to Constantinople. You can do a lot of things in this life, but you do not even hint that you're going to mess with the grain supply from Egypt. Constantine ordered the polarizing bishop banished to Gaul. After Constantine's death, the pro-Orthodoxy Western bishops began to petition Constantine II to allow Athanasius to return to his post in Alexandria. Seeing a golden opportunity to establish friendly relations with the Christian leadership in his provinces, Constantine II canceled Athanasius' exile and granted his request for return passage to Egypt. Now, the various exiles and returns from exile that this controversial bishop endured during his life, I think there were like 5 total rounds in all, would be important to document for a comprehensive history of the church. But that's not exactly what we're doing here. So the big takeaway from all of this is that we must understand how much Constantine II's decision to free Athanasius annoyed his brother Constantius II. Because Constantius was, wait for it, a staunch Arian. So just over a decade had passed since Constantine had made Christianity the religion of the emperors, and already doctrinal disputes were percolating their way up into the imperial court. Almost from the start then, Constantine's dream of one church supporting one emperor turned out to be something of a pipe dream, as rival factions within the church were now supporting rival factions within the imperial family. Each side was playing for keeps, and one side had just convinced Constantine II to let an almost certainly seditious leader loose in Constantius's, their enemy's, domain. Constantius was not at all happy about this. It's an issue that likely would have come to a head eventually, but at that particular moment, Constantius was bogged down fighting an inconclusive war against the Sassanids, and Constantine II was about to find out just how little Constance was willing to be pushed around. So they didn't have time to have it out over Athanasius. In 338, the eldest and youngest of the three brothers met in Moesia to reassess their respective borders, and it appears that Constance, at least face-to-face, was willing to concede the issue. His older brother's rhetoric was getting mighty bellicose, so Constance agreed to hand over the African provinces to Constantine in the interest of imperial unity. At least, that's what he said. In practice, he was not going to go down that easy. For all of the rest of 338, the two brothers went off and defended their frontiers. Constance campaigned along the Danube against the Sarmatians, and Constantine campaigned against the Alemanni along the Rhine. But as 338 gave way to 339, the African provinces had still not been handed over to Constantine as per the agreement. Constantine complained, which prompted Constance to finally begin the administrative handover. But even then, he told his brother that the city of Carthage and most of its surrounding territory was not going to be handed over. That land, Constance announced, was henceforth to be considered a part of Italia. Now, of course, on the one hand, that makes no kind of sense. But on the other hand, it makes perfect sense. That part of the North African coast was the key supplier of grain to Italy. Giving up control of it meant giving up any hope of self-sufficiency. From a geographic point of view, arguing that Carthage was a part of Italy was and is insane. But from a military and political point of view, that section of the North African coast had to be considered a part of Italy. In the ensuing back and forth, Constantine pointed out that arguing Carthage wasn't a part of Africa was insane, and Constance pointed out that he didn't really care, because he wasn't going to give up Carthage. Constantine tried to play the "I am technically still your guardian, so do what I say" card, and Constance countered with his "you know, I'm an adult now, and you can't tell me what to do" card. As 339 gave way to 340, the issue had still not been resolved, and tensions were rising. Constantine eventually became so angry over Constance's stonewalling that he decided to take the ultimate step. As the eldest brother, he could only allow so much disrespect before honor and dignity required that he do something about it. With Constance busy on the Danube campaigning once again against the Sarmatians, Constantine II was ordered by dignity and honor to invade Italy. Word of the invasion reached Constance at his Dacian headquarters, and he immediately dispatched a company of his best troops to keep Constantine busy until Constance could extract himself safely from his northern campaign and come have it out with his brother in person. but there never would be any need for him to come. Shortly after invading, Constantine was running an operation near Aquileia when he was ambushed by enemy forces. In the ensuing fight, Constantine II was killed. He was 24 years old and had been in Augustus for just about 3 years. It is probably too strained an analogy to call Constantine II the Fredo of the family, but between his failure to take charge after the death of his father, to his acquiescing to a power-sharing agreement that didn't favor him, to his whining about said power-sharing agreement after the fact, and finally, to his botched invasion that led to his death, Constantine II does not really jump out and say, "I was a great leader, cut down before my time." More like, "I'm not really the equal of my brothers politically or militarily, and it was just a matter of time before something like this happened to me." Dead on the battlefield or dead in a rowboat, I think that's where Constantine II was headed from day one. In a mirror to the reaction of his brothers following the massacre of the princes, this time it was Constantius who found himself taking the news of a family member being killed off in stride. In the brutally unsentimental world Constantine's sons had been raised in, the loss of a brother was not seen as the loss of a brother, so much as the elimination of a rival. Now, the empire was neatly divided in two between Constantius and Constance, a much more satisfying state of affairs for both of them than the unwieldy five-way split that their father had left him with and the three-way split that they had just dealt with. I have no doubt that each harbored dreams of winning sole control of the empire, but for now, each was fine to let the other have his half. Constance ruled the west and Constantius the east. It was a power-sharing agreement that would last for a full decade, and though they came close, it was also a power-sharing agreement that never devolved into open war. In the end, it was Constance's loss of support amongst the men of the Rhine legions that did him in, rather than the machinations of his Machiavellian brother. Next week, we will push on to that fateful year of 350 AD and watch as Constance falls, Magnentius rises, and Nepotianus makes his adorable little bid for power.